government and a number of current and former government officials on Wednesday, 3rd of April, the 23rd day of the blessed month of Ramadan. The leader started off by saying a few words about the blessed month of Ramadan. Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Ramadan is a blessed month in every sense of the word. This month truly is a blessed month as it develops and improves the inner spiritual abilities of individuals in various ways. It elevates people in both their human and divine characteristics. The betterment of individuals in society leads to the betterment of society as a whole." Commenting on fasting and the recitation of the Holy Quran, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "This has been emphasized and encouraged for this month, with people being promised increased reward. Beseeching God, reading supplications and reciting the recommended prayers for this month. Additionally, there is the night of Qadr, which presents an extremely important opportunity because the night of ordainment, or the night of Qadr, is better than 1,000 months. And there are various other aspects. With regards to fasting, fasting during the month of Ramadan develops an individual's ability to resist temptations. This is very important. A person's carnal desires never end. The more one responds to these desires, the more the cravings and expectations of the human's carnal self increases. It is necessary for a person to have the strength to curb these desires. Fasting gives us this strength. It allows us to practice strengthening our willpower and spirit and also controlling the never-ending desires of our carnal self. This is just one way to improve ourselves." Further remarks, the leader said, "Reciting the Holy Quran for those who reflect on its meaning refers to connecting to the endless sea of Islamic teachings. We have a constant need to be able to strengthen divine understanding in our hearts and to raise the level of our own understanding and insight. In the Quranic verse, 'To him ascends the good word.' A major part of this good word is the understanding that enters the human self from the Quran." The leader added, "The supplications that have been recommended for the month of Ramadan, at Sahar, the time before the morning call to prayer, during the nights, during the days, and on special days such as the first day of the month of Ramadan, immerse the human heart in remembrance of God. If a person pays attention to these supplications, it will lead to one building God's remembrance in himself or herself and a connection with God in a suitable way. According to this noble verse of the Holy Quran, 'And the remembrance of Allah is surely greater.' The main benefit of the ritual prayers is the remembrance of God, which brings happiness, progress, betterment and improvement and helps one to avoid sin. Turning to the night of ordainment, or the night of Qadr, the leader said, 'The night of Qadr is a night of destiny. During the month of Ramadan, one can shape one's destiny by harmonizing with the night of Qadr. This is not a trivial matter. This is of great importance for those who earnestly pursue it. What is needed during these nights is asking and a yearning to ask. And of course, the night of Qadr stands out from all the other nights of the year. The rest of the nights of Ramadan have more or less the same attributes. These are what develop, cleanse and polish the intellect and the human mind and the human heart. When these qualities exist in an individual, they have a ripple effect in the wider society. The collective identity of society is shaped by the identities of individual members of society. Once we are able to correct ourselves, our influence on society increases accordingly. This is what strengthening the self really means." Commenting further, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Ramadan is a month that is related to society. It is the month of helping others. It's the month of giving charity and showing kindness. It's the month of iftar, the evening meal for breaking the fast, and giving iftar to others that has been so highly recommended. It isn't told to just give iftar to the less fortunate. The spirit of being in contact with and helping others, being together and showing kindness to others are some of the special features of the month of Ramadan. Therefore, Ramadan presents a wonderful opportunity for spiritual healing. Throughout the year, we suffer from wounds to our soul and to our lives. Every sin inflicts a wound. Much like physical injuries, they harm a person's soul, creating a wound. Ramadan, which is the month of seeking God's forgiveness, is the month of repairing these wounds inflicted during the rest of the year. We should be able to emerge from this month with a healthy soul, God willing. If you have not forgiven us in what has passed of this month of Ramadan, then forgive us in what remains of it, since this is the month of seeking God's forgiveness." Ayatollah Khamenei added, "The concept of istighfar, seeking God's forgiveness and repentance, in the Islamic teaching is a very important matter. It is not specific to just personal issues either. Repentance with regards to a personal sin is one thing, and repentance with regard to a sin in society is another thing. The Holy Quran states that, "Now turn penitently to your Maker and slay the guilty among your folks." This is with regards to sins in society. So when a sin is committed in society, the members of society or those responsible for creating the sin and the repercussions resulting from it must seek God's forgiveness, and they must repent. Turning to the economy, the leader emphasized that the realities of Iran's economy are both bitter and sweet. The bitter facts regarding Iran's economy include inflation, fluctuating and unstable prices, the national currency decreasing in value, and widening gap between the rich and the poor. The sweet facts about Iran's economy include the building of essential infrastructure, the revival of a large number of factories and workshops which had been shut down or were about to be shut down, manufacturing, production and employment, the establishment of thousands of high-tech, knowledge-based companies with a young, energetic, highly skilled and highly motivated workforce, and the many innovative and high-tech products which these companies produce. The good news is that these companies will gradually turn around and boost Iran's economy. Commenting further, the leader said, "The people of this country quite rightly expect the economic decisions and economic initiatives undertaken by officials and government to have a tangible and positive effect on their daily lives. This is a reasonable expectation, and the government and officials and managers must work towards realizing and achieving this expectation. It is a reasonable expectation, since the country is endowed and blessed with extraordinary capacities and natural resources, as well as an excellent human resources." Turning to the slogan of the year, "Leap in production together with people's participation," Ayatollah Khamenei said, "The main purpose of this slogan is to focus the attention of everyone on facilitating the participation of people in economic activities, and in the true sense of the word, to use the people's financial, mental and intellectual capabilities, along with their innovation and creativity, to improve the economy. Some believe that if people become involved in the economy and its management, this will limit the authority of the government. However, this is a misconception. Responsibilities should be divided among government officials and the people. When I say the government, I do not only mean the government itself, I'm also referring to semi-governmental entities as well. There is no difference, and we must allocate tasks. Some tasks are the responsibility of the government. Other tasks are the responsibility of the people. The leader emphasized that the way should be opened up for people to be able to engage in economic activities, and that this will greatly strengthen the country and stabilize the economy. Turning to the situation in occupied Palestine, the leader said, "It is important to keep Gaza as the first priority in public opinion worldwide. This is an extremely important point. From what I understand of recent history, the atrocities occurring in Gaza are unprecedented. These kinds of crimes, the mass killings, genocide and attacks on women, children, patients, hospitals, and these tragedies that took place in hospitals are truly horrific. It is so terrible that even those who have been brought up in Western culture, in Europe and in the United States itself, are crying out in protest. Despite not having full access to information, they're taking action based on their limited knowledge of what is happening. This is how severe the crimes of the Zionist regime are. And this is truly an important point. It is also very important in another sense. That is the fact that the Zionist regime has suffered two major defeats in Gaza. The first defeat it suffered was due to the Al-Aqsa flood operation on 7th of October last year, which, as I have mentioned before, cannot be compensated for. That is truly how it is. That defeat has not been compensated for, and it will never be compensated. A regime that relies on the accuracy of its intelligence, on the development of its military capabilities, and on its military superiority, claiming that it is aware of what's going on around it, experienced an intelligence defeat of this magnitude at the hands of Palestinian resistance group with limited resources. This was the first defeat of the Zionist regime suffered. The defeat has not been compensated for, and it will never be compensated for. The second defeat is a defeat that is experienced over the past 6 months. From the first day when they entered the battlefield, they declared certain goals to make up for their first defeat, but they have been unable to achieve any of these goals in the past 6 months. They have launched attacks using all kinds of weaponry and equipment with the unfailing help of the United States, which has helped the Zionist regime with military, financial, and political assistance. The United States has vetoed several resolutions at the UN Security Council. The latest resolution, which in some ways it could not veto, is said to be non-binding. The Zionist regime is massacring women and children because it has failed to be able to confront the resistance fighters. It feels powerless there, becomes agitated, attacks innocent, defenseless women and children, and has killed over 30,000 Palestinians. Most of them women and children. This defeat will definitely continue. They have fallen into a trap of their own making. They have thrown themselves into a trap from which there is no escape. Commenting further on this year's International Quds Day rallies and marches, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "This year's International Quds Day rallies and marches against the usurping Zionist regime were more enthusiastic than ever before. In previous years, International Quds Day was only observed in Islamic countries, but this year, International Quds Day was magnificently observed in non-Islamic countries too. the people of Iran showed their full support for their Palestinian brothers and sisters. In concluding remarks, the leader wished God's greetings, mercy and blessings upon all those present.
Welcome to Have It Out with Galloway, where every week we have out the great issues of the day. As the Rolling Stones once sang, this could be the last time. By which I mean it is distinctly possible that by next week's show, the world will be engulfed in war. Certainly the region from the Atlantic Ocean to the Persian Gulf may very well be in flames. This is because, fundamentally, of the behavior of the apartheid state of Israel, the European colonial state of Israel, which for 75 years has tormented, has tortured, has murdered, displaced, and dispersed millions of Palestinian people. And Iran's long-standing and absolutely sincere conviction that it is a duty, a religious duty, a duty in humanity to stand by the Palestinian people. Make no mistake about it. If Iran did not stand with Palestine, none of what's happening, none of what's being said and threatened would be remotely the case. Iran would be courted, as it once was, as a potential ally for the West in the East. Iran would be a darling, as it once was, of the Western Empire. But Iran has never given up on the Palestinian people, even when others have. I spoke in the House of Commons yesterday. I'm trending in Twitter in the UK because, frankly, I was the only adult in the room, pointing out that the Prime Minister of Britain made a lengthy statement about the events of last weekend without a single word of condemnation or even a single word at all about the blatantly, brazenly illegal, violent, fatally violent act conducted by the apartheid state on the 1st of April in Damascus. As I said in the Parliament yesterday, not one word did the Prime Minister say about the destruction of the Iranian consulate in Damascus in violation of the Vienna Convention, in violation of all rules and laws of the United Nations Charter and of international law. And yet, obviously, the events on the 1st of April were the proximate cause, reason for the events of last weekend over in the skies over the apartheid state. But not one word was mentioned until I rose to my feet. The fact that my intervention has now been viewed by millions and millions of people, when so many dozens of people spoke, many of them much more powerful than me in terms of the positions that they hold, the fact that it is my intervention that is dominating the public discourse proves something very important. The British public are not fools. They know essentially what's going on in the Middle East, and that Palestine is the heart of the matter. The massacre of 35,000 and more, most of them women and children, trapped in a cage, with nowhere to run, with nowhere to hide, with no anti-aircraft potential, no aircraft, no warships, no bomb shelters. Not like the bunker that Netanyahu spent the weekend in the basement of the house of an American billionaire in Tel Aviv. The truth is, the British public and the Western public know that their governments are on the road to nowhere, making ourselves more and more hated, more and more imperiled and in danger, our interests damaged everywhere by our unending support for a tiny little country of just a few million people on the Mediterranean. We'll be discussing with the first-rate, first-line, top-class guest, Dr. Said Mohammed Marandi from the University of Tehran. This is Have It Out with Galloway. Professor Said Mohammed Marandi is the head of the American Studies Department at the University of Tehran. He's become a very familiar face and voice in Western media because he's not easy for them to dismiss. He's not easy for them to rubbish. He speaks the language. He speaks the language of wisdom, of international diplomacy, statecraft, and the language of finding solutions to problems rather than exacerbating them. I frequently have the honor of having him as a guest on my shows, and I have that honor again today. Now, very dangerous times, Professor. Welcome to the show. Will this be my last show? Is there going to be an all-out war by next week?
Well, I hope we are all able to benefit from your excellent show for a very long time. I do think it's quite possible that there will be an escalation. If the Israeli regime says they're going to target Iranians again, then if they don't do so, it would be a humiliation in itself. So I think they've put themselves in a position where they feel that they have to carry out an attack. And this is where I think the West miscalculates and misunderstands, because the West constantly believes its own propaganda, like in Ukraine, where the Ukrainians were always winning, and then suddenly everyone sees that they're losing. It's because of the Western propaganda that has for 2 years been saying that they've been wiping out the Russian armed forces, and then suddenly everyone wakes up to the reality that Kiev is under threat. In the case of Iran and the Israeli regime, the Israelis have lost in Gaza on the battlefield. They've lost on the border with Lebanon on the battlefield. They've created hatred for the regime across the globe because of the genocide. And after striking the Iranian embassy, the globe was outraged. The European countries and the United States are marginalized nowadays in the international community. They, of course, support the strike on the embassy, which is seen as outrageous, just as their support for the genocide is seen as outrageous across the globe. But their propaganda basically has been that the Israelis won when the Iranians struck back and retaliated and punished Israel for the airstrike, whereas that is absolutely not the case. It is the opposite. The Iranians sent large numbers of very inexpensive and old drones, each costing at most $10,000, and they told the world well in advance, because the Iranians wanted to draw fire towards those drones. They wanted the Israeli regime and the Americans to throw everything they had at the drones. And that's what they did. So the Iranians spent maybe a couple of million dollars on the drones, and the Israelis spent over $1.3 billion of dollars in missiles to shoot down those drones. And they didn't get any intelligence from Iran because they were all old. And the Iranians gained a huge amount of intelligence about Israeli and U.S. capabilities. And of course, they depleted their reserves of drones, whereas Iran has endless amounts of drones and missiles. Then the Iranians fired a number of older missiles, again, no new technology, getting rid of these old missiles. They also were, like the drones, fired to draw the anti-aircraft missiles towards themselves, and they were successful as well. So these drones and those older missiles, which had, as I said, no new technology in them for the West or Israel to discover, they all fulfilled their objective. They made they forced the other side to carry out a costly missile attack on the drones and missiles, and they gathered a huge amount of information. So they were decoys. They were all decoys. Then, to send the real message to Israel, they sent a handful, maybe 10 to 20, I'm not quite sure about the number, of missiles to an air base in the south, where the F-35s are, which bombed Gaza and which bombed the embassy, and a military intelligence base in the north. Those drones, those missiles all got through. Even those missiles weren't Iran's latest technology. They were older missiles, but they went right through the defense, and they showed the Israeli regime, and there's footage of them. There's footage, at least a number of drones and satellite. There's footage of the drones striking and satellite pictures showing that they struck. So it was a success from the Iranian point of view. But the problem is that when the West puts out this propaganda, as usual, they believe their own propaganda. And I think that may actually help to create miscalculation. And then this time around, if the Israelis strike, which they've threatened to do, the Iranians will hit back much harder. It will not be like what we saw 2-3 days ago. The Iranians have gathered their intelligence. The number of drones and missiles will be much greater. They will not be giving days of telling everyone days before that they're going to carry out the attack. It will be a sudden counterstrike if the Israeli regime does anything. And there will be thousands instead of hundreds. So the Israeli regime will be devastated. The Iranians have promised to give a crushing response this time around. So if the Americans and the Israelis keep gloating, then they may do something very stupid. Then they'll see the reality of Iran's capabilities.
We'll explore the likely meaning of that reality in a minute, Professor. David Cameron, when asked on Sky News in the unlikely figure of Kay Burley, who became the biggest journalist in the country with this question. When Cameron was fulminating about what Iran had done in response to the attack on its embassy, he was asked by Kay Burley, well, what would Britain do if such a thing happened to one of our embassies? And he more or less said, we'd do exactly the same as Iran has done, a real parade, Professor, of hypocrisy. But let's move on from them and talk about you, talk about Iran. I think there's a very strong case for saying, as George W. Bush might have put it, that they've all misunderstood Iran. They think of Iran as some kind of, I don't know, a Victorian-era northwest frontier province. But the reality is, Iran is a real substantial military power with 41 million people of fighting age, as opposed to 3 million people of fighting age in the apartheid state. Do you think they have, that this all stems from an underestimation of Iranian capability?
Yes, I think that they forget that even after the collapse of the Soviet Union and after the U.S. victory in Kuwait over the foolish Saddam Hussein, when the United States was at the top of the world and they became what someone once called a hyperpower, and we had reached supposedly the end of history, as Fukuyama said. Back then, the United States never dared to attack Iran because Iran was much more powerful than Iraq or Afghanistan. In the 90s, they didn't do it. After they invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, they didn't do it because Iran was simply too powerful. And the ideology that dominates Iranian society, especially this the view, this religious ideology, and this the way in which people in Iran view Karbala and Imam Hussein, this the Americans know that there would be, they always knew that there would be many people who would stand against their aggression, and ultimately that the Americans would lose. The Iranians would be highly motivated in the defense of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so the Americans always constantly threatened the country, but they always stood back and were careful not to enter Iranian territory. That was then, but this is now. Iran today is much more powerful. It has developed a very high-tech military industry. The West claims that Iran is assisting the Russians in and giving them advanced technology to fight their war in Ukraine. Whether it's true or false is irrelevant. The point is that they acknowledge Iran's advanced capabilities, its advanced technology, its advanced weapons system, the systems that have been developed indigenously. And Iran today has allies across the region. Back then, Iran was isolated. And after the Americans invaded Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan, Iran was surrounded by American bases and American soldiers. But today, Iran has allies in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, and the U.S. allies across the region are despised because their own population, their populations are witnessing a genocide in Gaza take place in front of our eyes as we speak, but their regimes do nothing if not support the Israelis directly or indirectly carry out the genocide. So these regimes are becoming increasingly vulnerable. Those that do trade with Israel, those who do business or who have political contacts or who have military cooperation, they are losing their legitimacy in the eyes of their own people. Indeed, even in Turkey, despite the rhetoric of the president, we've seen how Turkey has continued to do business as usual with the Israeli regime, provided with fuel from the Caucasus and Central Asia, export and import goods. And where did that lead the president of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan, during the local elections? He was wiped out. Why? Because many of his supporters went and voted for other parties, both religious and secular. So those that are siding with Israel are growing weaker. Those that are siding with the resistance are growing stronger. And the resistance is not just Iran and those in its partners in Yemen and Lebanon and elsewhere. The resistance is growing across the world. The global South has turned against Israel. And we see that young people and people from all walks of life in the West have turned against Israel. Young Jews, young Christians, young Muslims, young Hindus, people from different walks of life. They are now a part of this broader resistance against genocide, against what the Brazilian president called the Holocaust, effectively. And I think that the isolation of Israel and its regional friends will increase, and the isolation of the West will increase, and that puts Iran and the resistance in a commanding position.
Indeed so. Professor Marandi, as always, thank you for that tour of the horizon. Let's go to Zebonisa Rao in London. Zebonisa, welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. And greetings to everyone. So my question is a mixture of kind of frustration, complaint, and finally a question. It's a follow-up to your last program where it was mentioned the greed of governments and the Pope being Catholic discussion. Mm-hmm. So we've witnessed a six-month-long genocide. We spent every day analysing, assessing how will this country react, what will happen next. At the same time, logics and facts, humanity and law, they no longer exist. They don't exist for the criminals in power. We pray for a positive end to the conflict. South Africa, the Houthis and Iran, they are the only heroes in the story. So, I mean, I would pose the question, I know you've touched on it just now, that another elephant in the room is that the world governments are actually supporting basically a business plan through Israel. It's land, oil, gas, ethnic cleansing. Financial gain is their motivator. And when financial gain is involved, then human nature will not give up under any circumstance. It doesn't matter how many deaths, what kind of havoc it wreaks. This is the only fact that matters. So my complaint is that why isn't this addressed directly? And my question, the second part of it is that if we stop working through the established channels and fitting into the required narratives, wondering why we're in the same place? The definition of a democracy isn't that the opposite of a dictatorship, and it feels like we are under a global dictatorship. I'm sure that the people in power want to change the status quo, and they would know how to. But a major hurdle in the fact that the UN has military power that it cannot use is that the P5 member states' consensus is impossible. So the present rules that we live under are corrupt and are essentially they're a cage for us. And they're not even being followed by Israel and the Western governments. What can the vast majority of the world who wants them changed, what can they do to change them? And there's a term.
Well, in two words, ma'am, popular power, people's power. We have to find ways to assert our popular power over the prevailing orthodoxy, which misgoverns us. And I'll come back to that, how we can do that in a minute. But I'm one of these, and I've been, if you think about it, for more than half of my adult life, I have been sitting in the British Parliament, as I am again now. I've been a part of the debates in which this and that structure of so-called international law, of rules-based orders, and all the other guff that we hear endlessly. And I concluded long ago that all of this is just lipstick on a pig. And the point about lipstick is that it can be wiped off any time. It's there for the prettification of what is essentially a pig with all its ugliness. But if necessary, the lipstick can easily be wiped off. And we are seeing that now. You see, I'm so old, I remember when Britain prided itself on being not corrupt, unlike Johnny Foreigner, who was always said to be governed by corrupt politicians, corrupt governments, had an independent civil service which served the public and not any political party, which had a police force that you could safely anticipate that if your children were in trouble, the first thing they should do is ask a policeman. That had a court system that was independent from the political process and where you could expect justice. That had a BBC, which was the gold label of international journalism. That had an armed forces that were there to defend us and had defended us for a time alone against the Nazi hordes, that we had freedom of speech, that we had a genuine democracy. All of these things, every one of the things that I have just adumbrated, is now a shadow of its former self, except where it no longer exists at all, where no one even pretends that it exists. So I don't believe we're living either under the United Nations Charter of International Law, which was the pre-1999 spoken iteration of how we live, or a rules-based international order, leaving aside who made the rules, when were they made, who was consulted about, leave all that aside. Now they're no longer even pretending to adhere to any kind of rules. They break the rules they said yesterday were the rules that everyone must apply to. The best example this week, and there's an example every week, is the failure to condemn the destruction of the Iranian embassy consulate in Damascus. So we have to build an alternative power. We have to build an alternative media, and that's what I'm trying to do with this show, with the mother of all talk shows, with my social media platforms, and so on. We have to have a new political option on the ballot paper. Again, what I'm trying to do, I'm the leader of the Workers' Party of Britain. I'm trying to give the people somewhere else better to vote than the two cheeks of the same backside of the Uni Party. And we need to be demonstrating, as millions of people have all round the Western world for more than 6 months now, in the bitter cold of winter for the most part. We need to be boycotting, divesting, taking sanctions against the biggest criminals in the international arena. We need to be educating ourselves. I tell our young people in our party, read before you think, and think before you write, speak, and act. Thank you to all our panel. I think the best show we've had so far. Thank you to Professor Marandi for his expertise. And above all, thanks to you. Have it out with Galloway.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There was no calls by Western leaders for restraint as Israel bombed Gaza into ruins week after week, striking its hospitals, leveling its government offices, blowing up its universities, mosques, and churches, and destroying its bakeries. Rather, President Biden has repeatedly rushed through emergency arms sales, bypassing Congress to make sure Israel has enough bombs to keep destroying Gaza and killing its children. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Middle East, I wrote, suddenly Western politicians, from U.S. President Joe Biden to British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, have become ardent champions of restraint in a very last-minute scramble to avoid regional conflagration. Iran launched a salvo of drones and missiles at Israel in a retaliatory move. The United Nations Security Council was hurriedly pressed into session, with Washington and its allies calling for a de-escalation of tensions that all could too easily lead to the outbreak of war across the West Asia region and beyond. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, told the meeting, "Neither the region nor the world can afford more war. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate." The Zionist regime, meanwhile, vowed to exact the price against Iran at a time of its choosing, but the West's abrupt conversion to restraint needs some explaining. After all, Western leaders showed no restraint when the Zionist regime bombed Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing a senior general and more than a dozen other Iranians, the proximate cause of Tehran's retaliation. Under the Vienna Convention, the consulate is not only a protected diplomatic mission, but is viewed as sovereign Iranian territory. The Zionist regime's attack on it was an unbridled act of aggression, the supreme international crime, and the Nuremberg Tribunal ruled at the end of the Second World War. For that reason, Tehran invoked Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which allows it to act in self-defense. And yet, rather than condemning the Zionist regime's dangerous belligerence, a flagrant attack on the so-called rules-based order, so revered by the U.S., Western leaders lined up behind Washington's favorite client state. At the Security Council meeting on April 4th, the U.S., Britain, and France intentionally spurned restraint by blocking a resolution that would have condemned Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate, a vote that, had it not been stymied, might have sufficed to placate Tehran. Recently, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron still gave the thumbs up to Israel's flattening of Iran's diplomatic premises, saying he could completely understand the frustration Israel feels, though he added, without any hint of awareness of his own hypocrisy, that the UK would take very strong action if a country bombed a British consulate. By shielding the Zionist regime from any diplomatic consequences for its acts of war against Iran, the Western powers, in short Tehran, would have to pursue a military response instead. But it did not end there. Having stoked Iran's sense of grievance at the UN, Biden vowed ironclad support for the Israeli regime and grave consequences for Tehran should it dare to respond to the attack on its consulate. Iran ignored those threats. Recently, it launched hundreds of drones and missiles at the same time, protesting vociferously about the Security Council's inaction and silence, coupled with its failure to condemn the Israeli regime's aggressions. And Western leaders failed to take note. They again sided with Israel and denounced Tehran. At the recent Security Council meeting, the same three states, the US, the UK, and France, that had earlier blocked a statement condemning the Zionist regime's attack on Iran's diplomatic mission, sought a formal condemnation of Tehran for its response. Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, ridiculed what he called the parade of Western hypocrisy and double standards. "You know very well that an attack on a diplomatic mission is a casus belli under international law. And if Western missions were attacked, you would not hesitate to retaliate and prove your case in this room." There was no restraint visible either as the West publicly celebrated its collusion with Israel in foiling Iran's attack and thereby effectively making itself a direct party to this dangerous confrontation. The restraint the West demands relates only, it seems, to Iran's efforts to defend itself. Given the West's newfound recognition of the need for caution and the obvious dangers of military excess, now may be the time for its leaders to consider demanding restraint more generally, and not just to avoid a further escalation between Iran and the child-killing regime of Israel. Over the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has bombed Gaza into rubble, destroyed its medical facilities and government offices, and martyred and maimed many, many tens of thousands of Palestinians. In truth, such is the devastation that Gaza some time ago lost the ability to count its dead and wounded. At the same time, the Zionist regime has intensified its 17-year blockade of the tiny enclave to the point where so little food and water are getting through. The population are in the grip of famine. People, especially children, are literally starving to death. The International Court of Justice, the world's highest court, chaired by an American judge, ruled back in January, when the situation was far less dire than it is now, that a plausible case had been made the Zionist regime was committing genocide, a crime against humanity strictly defined in international law. And yet, there were no calls by Western leaders for restraint as the Zionist regime bombed Gaza into ruins week after week, striking its hospitals, leveling its government offices, blowing up its universities, mosques, and churches, and destroying its bakeries. Rather, President Biden has repeatedly rushed through emergency arms sales, bypassing Congress to make sure the Zionist regime has enough bombs to keep destroying Gaza and killing its children. When the Zionist regime leaders vow to treat Gaza's population like human animals, denying them all food, water, and power, Western politicians gave their assent. Sunak was not interested in recruiting his brave RAF pilots to protect civilians in Gaza from Israel, and Starmer showed no concern about the fear and instability felt by Palestinians from Israel's reign of terror. Quite the reverse. Starmer, famed as a human rights lawyer, even gave his approval to Israel's collective punishment of the people of Gaza, its complete siege, as integral to a supposed Israeli right of self-defense. In doing so, he overturned one of the most fundamental principles of international law, that civilians should not be targeted for the actions of their leaders. As is now all too apparent, he confirmed a death sentence on the people of Gaza. Where was restraint then? Similarly, restraint went out of the window when Israel fabricated a pretext for eradicating the UN agency UNRWA, the last lifeline for Gaza's starving population. Even though the Zionist regime was unable to offer any evidence for its claim that a handful of UNRWA staff were implicated in an attack on Israel on October 7th, Western leaders hurriedly cut off funding to the agency. In doing so, they became actively complicit in what the World Court already feared was a genocide. Where was the restraint when Israeli officials, with a long history of lying to advance their regime's military agenda, made up stories about Hamas beheading babies or carrying out systematic rapes on October 7th? All of this was debunked by an Al Jazeera investigation drawing largely on the Israeli sources. Those genocide-justifying deceptions were all too readily amplified by Western politicians and media. The Zionist regime showed no restraint in destroying Gaza's hospitals or taking hostage and torturing thousands of Palestinians it grabbed off the street. All of that got a quiet nod from Western politicians. Where was the restraint in Western capitals when protesters took to the streets to call for a ceasefire to stop Israel's bloodletting of women and children, the majority of Gaza's dead. The demonstrators were smeared or still smeared by Western politicians as supporters of terrorism and anti-Semites. And where was the demand for restraint when the child-killing regime of Israel tore up the rule book on the laws of war, allowing every would-be strong man to cite the West's indulgence of Israeli atrocities as the precedent justifying their own crimes? On each occasion, when it favored Israel's malevolent goals, the West's commitment to restraint went missing in action.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A damning report indicates that deaths from terrorism in Africa have skyrocketed more than 100,000% during the so-called U.S. War on Terror. The study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies revealed that during 2002 and 2003, when the U.S. was just beginning its decades-long war, a total of just 9 terrorist attacks were counted throughout all of Africa, leading to only 23 casualties. But after 2 decades of U.S. intervention in Africa with the purported aim of helping the continent in counter-terrorism, deaths from Takfiri violence in Africa increased to 23,322 last year, reaching a record level of lethal violence. An article published by the Responsible Statecraft website notes that these findings contradict claims by the U.S. military command in Africa, AFRICOM, that it is thwarting terrorist threats on the continent and promoting security and stability. So, what exactly are U.S. troops doing in Africa if they're not fighting terrorists as they claim? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we are focusing on an unprecedented upsurge of terrorism in Africa, amid the presence of U.S. troops across the continent. Our experts will give us their incisive analysis on how the U.S. has contributed to increased terrorist attacks in Africa.
U.S. increased terrorism in Africa. Imperialist powers led by the United States have long viewed the African continent as a place for stealing valuable assets. The continent has a huge chunk of the world's remaining mineral wealth and is home to major global oil and gas reserves. That is why the European powers and United States seek to control these resources by deploying their military forces across the continent under the pretext of combating terrorism.
It is now becoming clear to all that the presence of U.S.-led Western forces in Africa is the source of insecurity across the continent. Basuma Bazi, Burkina Faso's Minister of State, addressed the 78th session of the General Assembly of the United Nations last year and said Western troops operating in West Africa are out to plunder the region's resources.
We have some 10,000 soldiers, armed soldiers, that are foreign soldiers. Most of them are French soldiers, but there are also American soldiers, Germans, Italian, etc. They have weapons. They have flying equipment. They have surveillance equipment, which is the most sophisticated in the world. And yet, they don't see the hundreds of terrorists that are moving around in order to serve death and desolation, often with unimaginable weapons at their side. In Mali, in Niger, in Burkina Faso, there is no factory to manufacture weapons nor munitions. So, who is recruiting these terrorists? Who is training them? Who is providing them with weapons? Who feeds them and with what means? Do you believe in this philanthropy on behalf of whom the Westerners have sent their armies to the Sahel to die for our beautiful blue eyes? Well, if you believe that, then what justifies the diplomatic irritation and other gesticulation of France when we told them to skedaddle with their armies? The real reason is really about the resources that are underground in the Sahel. Indeed.
Well, for more on how the U.S. has contributed to the increase of terrorism in Africa, we have contacted Abdul Latif Ahmed, a researcher and a digital news editor. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Professor Abdul Wahab Sheikh Abdul Samad, the Chief Executive Officer of the Afro-Asia Institute for Strategic Studies, based in Nairobi, Kenya.